our first speaker is Jackie Patterson. She's the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Since 2007, she has served as coordinator and co-founder of Women of Color United. She has worked as a researcher, program manager, coordinator, advocate, and activist, working on women's rights, violence against women, HIV and AIDS, racial justice, economic justice, and environmental and climate justice. Her publications and articles include, and the titles are very instructive, Jobs versus Health, An Unnecessary Dilemma, Climate Change is a Civil Rights Issue, Gulf Oil Drilling Disaster, Gendered Layers of Impact, Disasters, Climate Change, Uproot Women of Color, and The People Shall Lead, Centralizing Frontline Community Leadership in the Movement Towards a Sustainable Planet. And book chapter, Equity in Disasters, Civil and Human Rights Challenges in the Context of Emergency Events. In the book, Building Community Resilience Post-Disaster. Jackie.
Good evening, everyone. I am glad to be here, and I'll be talking a little bit about some of the work that we do and some of the intersections that we see between racial justice issues, gender justice issues, and certainly environmental and climate justice. As per the collage, we really see this as a very intersectional set of issues. So we see the connection between civic engagement and political issues and criminal justice, health issues, pollution, and even the opportunities in the new, new green or the new energy economy. So next slide. So I'll start with this quote from Martin Luther King. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. And that really is kind of at the root of the challenges that we see in terms of the exploitation of the earth, exploitation of people, and the results that we see in terms of the slide towards catastrophic climate change and the rampant violation of human and civil rights. So we really, as the NAACP, see these issues of environmental and climate justice as civil rights issues. And often I get asked that question, like, oh, the NAACP is working on that, with surprise that we really view it as a civil and human rights issue. But you'll see as we talk through how we see these as being directly intersection. And so you see here when we talk about the energy, the way we generate energy now, whether it's coal-based energy production and the fact that 76,000 coal miners have died of lung disease since 1968, while year after year, the National Mining Association has used its lobby power with the legislature to fight against the very protections for in terms of regulations for coal mine dust that would have protected the workers that are employed by the folks who pay the fees for the National Mining Association. They fight actively against the well-being of their own workers. We also know that the coal-fired power plants are tend to be disproportionately located in communities of color and low-income communities, much to the health detriment of those communities. And even as we seek to look at alternatives, we have this notion of natural gas. We know that the ways that we get natural gas in terms of fracking gets into our water supply and then causes even our water supply to be explosive in some situations. There's a place called Brainbridge Township in Ohio where the explosivity level of the water was 20 times, it was 20%, which 20 times the allowable explosivity rate, of which is 1%, which I was surprised that there is an allowable explosivity rate, but that's a whole other thing. So next slide. And then the way these things get into our body, so whether it's pollution coming out of the smokestacks or going into the earth, because what goes up out of the smokestacks comes down in acid rain or gets into the earth through landfills or runoff or whatever, and then what gets into our waterways all ends up in our bodies, whether we're breathing it in or we're drinking it or whether we're eating it, in terms of even when we're trying to grow food we're often growing food in an intoxic soil. So we see respiratory illnesses, cardiovascular illnesses and others resulting from this exposure. And of course, all of us are exposed in some way, but communities of color and low-income communities are disproportionately exposed, and we see disproportionate levels of these kind of illnesses. Next slide. And so this is a family who gifted us with this image, and they're in the Four Corners region out west. And this family is standing in front of a coal-fired power plant, which is obviously just nearby them. And it's one of four coal-fired power plants within a 50-mile radius of where they live. And they have those two coolers on their porch because those the energy from those coal-fired power plants goes to power Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, while 70% of the people who live on this is a Navajo family, on this Navajo land do not even have electricity. So they get all the negative impacts in terms of the pollution from the coal plants, but don't even get the very thing that the coal plants produce, which is electricity, for the most part. Next slide. And then when we talk about the impacts of these, this is where we see some of these intersections also with the civil and human rights agenda of the NAACP and other social justice organizations. When we have exposure to coal or coal burning or incinerators or the many other types of toxic processes that happen in these communities, we have high rates of asthma that result. African-American families, African-American children are 3 to 5 times more likely to enter the hospital from an asthma attack and 2 to 3 times more likely to die of an asthma attack. And so, and then when we think about the social impacts of this, the other things that comes out of the smokestacks include mercury, arsenic, lead, and so forth. And 71% of African Americans live in counties in violation of air pollution standards, and 68% of African Americans live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant. And the family sent us the top two pictures, really showing us the life of Antoine, their grandson, who is dependent on those medicines to get from day to day. And they also sent the picture on the right showing that they thought this was emblematic of his life, often looking on while other children are playing, but he's not able to play like other kids because his lung capacity is low. Or he's looking out the window as other kids are going to school, but he's not able to go to school like other kids because on poor air quality days. And then we also know that with lead being one of the things that comes out of those smokestacks, as well as getting into folks' water supplies and so forth, and it's tied to attention deficit disorder. And so for these same communities, kids are either out of school because of poor air quality days, in school and having a hard time paying attention, or they are also often in places where their property values are lower, because if you're living next to a property value that's emitting these toxic things, on average your property values are 15% lower. And so you have under-resourced schools on top of kids having a hard time paying attention to school or having a time even going to school. And so for us, we know that studies show that if you're not on grade level by the third grade, you're more likely to enter into the school-to-prison pipeline. And so we think of that for children like Antoine and other children who are in harm's way. Next slide. And so then we see the other impacts. So these same facilities that are disproportionately impacting these communities negatively in terms of their health are also the facilities that are contributing to climate change and its impacts on communities. And it's often these very same communities that are also food insecure. And as we see the shifts in agricultural yields resulting from climate change, it means food insecurity is already getting worse and will continue to get worse. I was just visiting a blueberry farm in Maryland, and as was stated before, I was actually visiting them in February, and I was expecting to kind of be, they said we were going to be in the greenhouse. I was thinking we were going to be out there with my coat on, and it was 80 degrees that day. And they were telling me that they had been operating for 25 years, but that the sad thing is that they feel like that's going to be their last year of operating, because they said the blueberries are blooming now, and we're not going to, they're going to frost, and it's going to destroy the crop, just like it's happened for the last 3 years. And they said we can't sustain our blueberry crops, and yet blueberries are a superfood, and that was actually, they were providing those blueberries to food insecure communities, and now they're no longer able to do that because of the impacts of climate change right here in Maryland, right nearby in Maryland. And so when we have these communities that are more likely to get their food out of a corner store, so more, heavier in preservatives, heavier in sodium, heavier in sugars, foods that are not only not good for you, but that are actively bad for you, especially when you have the chronic conditions that tend to proliferate in those communities, and that's only going to get worse in the context of climate change. Next slide. And then on the other side, we also have these same communities that are often more vulnerable in terms of the impacts of disasters and extreme weather events. Next slide. And when you tie together the fact that often these communities are the ones that are located next to these toxic facilities, sometimes with nuclear reactors, we all know what happened with Fukushima Daiichi and when it was impacted by a disaster. And as we wrestle with this notion of switching to natural gas, we also know that natural gas, that fracking is tied to increase in seismic activity. And a number of our nuclear reactors across the country are built on earthquake fault lines, which are being exacerbated by this fracking situation. So we're really, it's a recipe for disaster, and disproportionately for those communities that are host to those facilities, which again are communities of color and low-income communities. Next slide. And so the communities are then have these other social vulnerabilities that make them less likely to be able to survive these disasters. Next slide. And even if folks in prison, and after the Hurricane Katrina, the deputies actually abandoned the prisoners there and left them locked up for days. And so they didn't have food or water. They had to dig through the walls just to get ventilation. The sewage tainted waters were rising up and getting into their cells. And these are the kind of inhumane conditions that people are in the aftermath of disasters, which are only going to be on the increase. Next slide. And I'm on a code quest. I only have like 2 minutes left to have like 60 slides. Okay, yeah, 2 minutes. Thank you. So I'll just keep going quickly through and just kind of showing who's making decisions, but yet who's standing in line needing help. Also, another, this is important as we look at this kind of marriage between politics and decision making and money. This is our, this is a place in Plaquemines Parish in Louisiana, where the folks in that community were overtaken by Hurricane Isaac, which was 7 years after Hurricane Katrina. When they asked Senator Mary Landrieu why it was that those levees weren't fortified like other levees were fortified in the post-Katrina context, she said she asked the Army Corps of Engineers the same question, and they said that they use a formula to decide which levees are prioritized for fortification, and the formula applies points to each levee based on what the economic impact would be if they were overtaken only. And so Plaquemines Parish is a poor fisher folks, oyster folks community, large community of color, and they were just literally disregarded because they didn't have the property values that would have made them worth saving. And so Dr. Bullard calls it the wrong complexion for protection, but it is, whether it's economics or race, it's the same outcome. And so with sea level rise also impacting nations, and right here, Kivalina in Alaska, Thibodeau, Louisiana, in Louisiana. Then we'll go next slide. And so we're at the point where Noah is saying that today's flood is equal to tomorrow's high tide. Like, we're seeing 1,000-year floods every other year now in certain places. Thank you. So I'll say the rest in 30 seconds. Next slide. And so when we talk about intersections, next slide. We know that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, this is on the very same day where two articles ran in Associated Press, one with African-American fellow, another with two white American folks. And with the African-American young man, they said, a young man walks through chest-deep floodwaters after looting a grocery store in New Orleans. And with the white American picture, two residents wade through chest-deep waters after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store. And it's those kind of images and those kind of characterizations that lead to the next slide, the over-criminalization of certain communities and what leads to what happened on the bridge in terms of people being shot on the bridge just trying to escape with their lives. Next slide. And so we also talk about the gendered impacts that we know that in the aftermath of disasters, whether it's Katrina, earthquakes, the BP oil drilling disaster, things like sexual violence and domestic violence actually skyrocket after these disasters. So there's many, many gendered impacts, but that's just one. Next slide. And then we also talk about the fact that the U.S. is 4% of the global population, but 25% of the emissions that drive climate change. So we really see common cause in terms of looking at the punitive immigration policies that we're putting forward, when really we're the ones who are making other people's homes uninhabitable and really forcing this climate force migration. So this is related. This slide, I'll close with this quote. This is by Warshan Shire, a Kenyan-born poet. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. So, thank you.